Batya Unger Sargon is an American writer, journalist, and fearless intellectual. I first noticed her in 2017 when she was working at the Jewish newspaper The Forward. She seemed to come out of nowhere and made a lot of waves very quickly. Batya was super progressive, and she seemed to be everywhere, a fierce woke warrior defending the growing progressive cohort in the US and elsewhere. I've got to say, in the early days of her public intellectual life, I didn't really know what to make of her. It's not that you can't be left and intelligent, but she was way woke, and there was no inherent logic, to my mind, with the ideas she presented. Turns out that Batya had her come to Jesus moment over the following few years, and today we discuss her intellectual evolution and extraordinary integrity. Few people will revisit fundamental belief systems to which they have committed publicly, but Batya did and continues to do so. I was keen to speak with her, particularly now, because of a blistering takedown she delivered recently of people who have come out since October 7th and very stridently denied that Hamas committed any rape or sexual crimes against women, men, and children during their barbaric massacre and torture spree in Israel on October 7th. Like, straight-up denial. Even Jordan's Queen Rania, an American born to immigrants from Nablus, and who is now married to King Abdullah of Jordan, and who appears to be a quite vicious Jew hater, Queen Rania has made repeated comments stating that any reports of rape on October 7th are fabricated. In fact, an op-ed piece published in Newsweek on December 26, 2023, and written by physician and independent women's forum member Kanta Ahmed, just rips into Queen Rania and exposes her quite unanchored and undiplomatic comments on, well, Jews. Coincidentally, for those who are not aware, Batya is the editorial page editor of Newsweek, where this op-ed appeared. There were many reasons I was keen to have a chat with Batya, and she very graciously made time in the midst of a particularly busy week recently. I was surprised by only one thing, to learn that she feels that those who deny the facts of the Hamas sexual crimes are an odious but small and very vocal cohort representing certain elitist tribes, like academia and journalism. Batya dismisses their extreme views and anti-Semitism as being way outside what is considered to be acceptable behavior in America. I hope she's right, but I'm not yet convinced. She's so smart, so spunky. This podcast is a real treat. I'm Vivian Berkovich, former Canadian ambassador to Israel, and now living in the city that never sleeps, the awesome state of Tel Aviv. Stay with us. Welcome to State of Tel Aviv, Batya Unger Sargon. Such an honor to have you with us today.
I am very honored to be here with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Let's get to it, because I know you're on a tight clock and we have a lot to talk about today. You have had some fierce things to say, powerful, eloquent, so moving. I have been listening over and over in particular to a 10-ish minute commentary that you did last week, I believe, on the denialism of the Hamas rapes. But before we get into that, I want to just start and step back in time. I first became aware of you, Batya, 2016-17. And if I'm not mistaken, you were at The Forward at that time, correct?
I started at The Forward in 2017, I believe. See, this is why I don't like when they give Joe Biden a hard time about not remembering dates. I would have to look up in my email to find the date that I got married. I really have no idea what year it was. But I believe I was at The Forward 2017 to 2020. I'm pretty sure those were the years.
We're going to go with that. We'll go with that. And at the time, you were pretty, what I would call or have called at the time, woke, left woke.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Totally. Yeah.
Okay. So just so we all have the same floor, how would you describe woke?
To me, wokeness is when you take the difference between right versus wrong, which is a dichotomy that for human history we have used in order to guide our behavior, and you replace it with the difference between powerful versus powerless. And then you superimpose some characteristic onto that, whether it's skin color or race or sexuality or gender or national origin or religion. And you suggest that everyone with that characteristic has less power and everybody on the other side of it has more power. And the powerless is inherently virtuous. So their abjection is itself virtue, which means that they can do no wrong, or at least they cannot be held to the same standard as white people. And I'm embarrassed to admit that I completely was in that mindset. It's very hard to get through the university system in America without coming out in some way defined by this worldview. And thank God, Baruch Hashem, I managed to shed it.
And that was when I first encountered you, and I thought, she seems so smart, but I just, since we're being very candid here, I was like, how can she be saying these things? And then we fast forward, of course, to the present. We'll skip over the years in between. And I'm probably not incorrect in saying that you would no longer describe yourself as adhering to woke ideology. Is that true?
It's true. Although I still maintain that I am a leftist. I think the left abandoned leftism. Like, it's not like that they kicked me out of the left, which they tried to do. And it's that I'm the left and they are something else. They're something gross and godless and amoral and disgusting. And this is what left looks like. You know, it's like, yes, I had a big change of heart. It started in 2018 with this Yale study that I cite ad nauseum, which was the first inkling I had that there was something seriously wrong with my worldview. And it was the study that found that white liberals, as opposed to white conservatives, dumb down their vocabulary when they talk to people of color. So if they encounter a Black person or a Hispanic person, they will use a lower vocabulary than they will use when they talk to other white people, which is so disgusting. And I remember seeing the study and feeling just shook to my core. But it was so horrifying to see myself and my milieu and my worldview indicted in such a way, like laid bare for what it truly is, which is patronizing racist garbage. I remember I was at the Florida sitting in my office. I opened the drawer. I put it in the drawer, shut the drawer and said, I'm not ready to deal with the implication of what this means. And it took me, I would say, another year until 2019 when everything really started to blow up and it became clear that to be a member of good standing on the American and global left today, you have to denounce your Jewishness, refute your Jewishness for the pleasure of the anti-Semites. Then it became no longer possible for me to ignore this. And that's when everything started to crumble and I started to realize like the whole thing is just a racist facade.
Thank goodness you did, because you're so eloquent and such a strong advocate for decency and justice and fairness. And I don't care if you're on the right or the left or in the middle, it's the substance of what you say and that you have so much integrity in what you say. And this kind of epiphany of yours, realizing I'm with the wrong team or they're just, they've skidded way off course and I can't do this. And that more or less coincided with the Women's March and that period where we had so-called progressives, particularly in the U.S., saying you can't be a Zionist and a feminist.
Yeah, I was later to the train than some others. Tablet Magazine, Barry Weiss, like they were all saying that already in 2016, 2017. And it took me a while to get there myself. For the best of intentions,
yeah.
One wants to see oneself as on the side of, in the Torah, it says, Elokim mevakesh et hanirdaf, like Hashem looks after the oppressed, right? That is a godly characteristic, but I was wrong. And yeah, that whole idea of branding Zionism as racism, obviously there's like this whole Soviet history of having done that, right, as a way of marginalizing Israel because it was seen as a client state of the United States during the Cold War. But that's one of the hallmarks of the progressive left. And I struggle to tell my progressive Jewish friends, it's not that the progressives are right about everything and accidentally extremely racist about Jews and Israel, and you can convince them not to be. It's that the whole thing is underwritten by the same ideology that makes them be so wrong about Israel. They're wrong about Israel because they're wrong about everything in the same way.
And that takes us right into the main topic for today. I see that you have another fabulous book coming out, Second Class.
very soon, I know, and I look forward to reading it. I'm working on a book on the weaponization of sexual crimes on October 7th and subsequently by Hamas.
Wow.
Yeah. And the denialism that has overtaken any discussion in a public forum everywhere about this horror. And you've made some very compelling comments recently about this issue in particular. Let's get to it. October 7th happened. Where were you? Everyone has their little story. Probably. What's yours?
Yeah, I'm getting emotional. It's been a tough week. I think for a lot of people this week, a lot of those feelings from right after came back. I don't know why. It was such a stupid thing. I don't know why I was even watching the Oscars, but seeing somebody use this enormous platform to denounce the Jews was like, it brought up a lot of the feelings. On October 7th, I was in shul. It was Simchat Torah here, and or it was maybe using Saras, which meant there was a second day. So there were 2 days of Yontif, because it's in America, we have that second day. And people came to shul the first day. There were a few people who either had a cleaning lady or somebody, something, the newspaper arrived. And they said, there's been a huge terror attack in Israel. We were all like, oh, that's so horrible. And I remember the first thing the person said was, and they think that they got a hostage, a woman hostage. And we were all like, oh my God, lo aleinu, let it not be the case. She said, 40 dead. And in our naivete, like it brings tears to your eyes, the naivete, 40 dead, it can't possibly be. Like there's no way. For sure, this is just misinformation. The next day, there were a few more details. I don't remember exactly what they were. But I remember just thinking, I'm going to turn on my phone after Yontif and it's going to, there's no way that this is, and it kept growing and metastasizing. It was, no, surely some, these are rumors. And then of course I got home after the holiday, turned on my phone and just, that was it. Then I was in the, I think we were all in it. And it was amazing because I think for the first, I would say 2 or 3 months, I don't know if you had this, but the emotions, like I felt like I was living in a heightened reality. I don't think I'll ever have that again, where every emotion was so powerful. And it wasn't just the rage and the grief, but the euphoria of just having this clarity of good versus evil. There was something unbelievably euphoric about that. And knowing that we were all going to enter the good fight and for something, there's this kind of, we live in this, we think of ourselves as living in this postmodern time where a lot of the wokeness comes from the fact that most of the major fights have been won, right? Everybody wants to be the person who would have stood by Dr. King. And so now, ironically, they have to turn on Dr. King's vision to show, to prove that they're the like the real good guys, right? But I did. I felt for the first 2 weeks were just a horror. But after that, I started to develop this feeling of real euphoria, the shedding of the pretense that the left is good, or that they have the moral high ground, or that we have to care what they think. For so long, the Jonathan Glazer position of, we have to prove that we're the good Jews to the anti-Semites so they'll love us, right? That, sorry, it's not an accident that he has that British accent, right? That's very deep in the European mindset and the American left, the Jewish American left. To me, it was just like, to shed the last remnants of believing that you have to convince the, what I call them, the, our Hamas would never rape anybody brigade. Like the idea that we're answerable to them, it just went up in smoke. And there was such a release for me about that.
But did it? I have to say, I shared everything you're talking about, but not the euphoria, because it was immediately apparent to me on October 7th and October 8th. And I happened to be in Toronto at the time, which is much more like Europe than America also. And the hostility and the vilification of Jews and of Israel and the victims was immediate. The celebrations in the streets, the handing out of candy, it was just like we were in Ramallah. The crowds, long before Israel was falsely accused of having bombed a hospital on October 17th, many in Canada, millions were celebrating. Unions were celebrating. It's appalling. So I skipped the euphoria stage. To me, it was very clear, oh shit, this is going to get really bad for us really quickly. And it has. It did, and it has. And it's just continuing to get worse. So
Canada is, it's
a whole other
horrifying
world.
Horrifying what's happening there. Europe, horrifying what's happening there. Thank God I'm an American. Or a U.S., I don't know how Canadians call us. U.S. Americans?
We call you Americans. But still, globally, Batya, the denialism of the fact that these horrific crimes occurred, it looms. We have, not surprisingly, but still shockingly, the United Nations silent women's organizations, silent. The whole Me Too sisterhood, including in America, silent, refusing to come out, never mind denounce, even acknowledge these crimes. And in the face of more than enough evidence, including the gloating and bragging of Hamas thugs themselves, including, as you referenced at the outset, the video of 19-year-old Na'ama Levy, who had clearly been brutalized sexually in that short video where she's pulled out of the back of a Jeep by her hair. It's in America too, no? This denialism?
It's you're forcing me to ask myself, why am I so sanguine about this? I think it's very marginal in America. Like, there's a bunch of YouTube personalities, and they have a lot of YouTube followers because the globe watches YouTube, right? But in America, it is extremely marginal. And to me, I look at these people and think, you're never going to work in the mainstream again. Like, it's unacceptable in the mainstream. The only thing that happened was the New York Times Daily podcast shelving the episode about the rapes. That's disgusting. But the New York Times is disgusting. It's disgusting. Like, that's not a shock. And again, it's extremely marginal. I don't mean to dismiss it. It's, like I said, it's appalling. It's disgusting. But to me, these people are cockroaches. And I don't feel that I have to, they have not penetrated into the mainstream in any way at all. And the thing is like, you have the rape denialism, right? And you have the people who celebrate it, right? The American left starts at the ceasefire now stuff. That's why I feel like they wore those little pins to the Oscars. Let them have their little pins. I don't agree with the ceasefire position. But compared to the rape apologia, it's so not in any way comparable. Our far left is asking for a ceasefire, which is a legitimate position that I happen to disagree with. It is not anti-Semitic. Mark Ruffalo he's a very well-meaning, stupid person. He's not an anti-Semite. He just has silly politics. And that's our privilege as Americans. The American people, 80% of them back Israel. And the ones who don't, it's the vast majority of it is from a position that I don't agree with, but is not like anti-Jewish. It's not anti-Israel. They're looking at Gaza, and that is what they see. They can't, somebody in our newsroom at Newsweek said yesterday, they feel like Hamas attacked Israel and Israel is attacking Gaza. They don't understand like the intricacies of, no, this is Israel trying to get rid of Hamas, and it is Hamas that literally feeds its babies into the slaughter machine. So I feel, but I could be totally wrong, but having just spent the year interviewing working class people across the country, the anti-Semitism here, the rape denialism, the stuff that goes beyond legitimate opposition to Israeli policy that I disagree with, that stuff is all coming out of the elites. Like the chanting of from the river to the sea in America does not happen in working class neighborhoods like it does in Europe and in France and in England and in Canada. It happens on college campuses. And to me, it's just they're stupid and kids are supposed to be stupid. They're also cowards. Leftists are physical cowards. Like these people, we're not under physical threat in any way. That's their opinion. They're making it heard. They can't even get Joe Biden to like forcefully denounce Israel. He's here, he's going there. There's not even enough of them to change U.S. policy for real. Yeah, he's saying, oh, I don't like Bibi. Saying I don't like Bibi is a way of saying, Israel, keep going. You know, I got your back. So I feel sanguine about it, but I could be totally wrong. I could be completely wrong.
Are you concerned with what is going on in Israel? This is not just another crisis. State of Tel Aviv is committed to delivering superb and candid analysis, and we're offering a limited-time subscription special, a 33% discount from the regular fee of $90 annually. 1 year for only $60. Stay informed and stay connected with State of Tel Aviv. We are a reader-supported enterprise. If you value our work, please subscribe. It makes a huge difference. stateoftelaviv.com. All one word. Now, back to the podcast.
Wrong. You may think you feel sanguine about it, but you made some very fiery remarks about the way in which the Hamas apologists / rape deniers are justifying their position, how they see it. So I think what you're saying is that doesn't really prevail in America, may be prevalent in all these other places that you mentioned, But would you mind just like succinctly setting out what your view is of how the deniers see the rapes, how they justify them, how they can explain this savagery and barbarism and somehow show their face in public?
From their point of view, because they are woke, they have this binary of powerful versus powerless. The one with less power in any interaction, or who belongs to a group that has less power in any interaction, has inherent virtue. There is virtue bestowed upon them because their abjection and powerlessness is virtue. It's the only virtue that these postmodernists recognize. And they also believe that they have inherent virtue and no agency, right? White people have all the agency and people of color have no agency. So the reason that they feel that they don't judge them for committing heinous acts is because they don't really believe that they have the capacity to act at all. They have no agency. So any interaction between an oppressed, marginalized group and a person they consider to be part of the oppressor group, the agency is going to be transferred onto the oppressor, including if it is a woman who has been raped. If she is coded as white, the way that the wokes code Jews and Israelis, she is responsible because the Palestinian cannot act because they are part of a marginalized group that has less power. And that includes Hamas. So if you are a Hamas member and you are a butcher of babies and a rapist, but you belong to this group that is marginalized and has less power, which is how they code the Palestinians, any interaction between you and an Israeli, all of the agency has to be reassigned to the Israeli. All of the evil has to be reassigned to the Israeli. So when a Palestinian, a Hamasnik, rapes an Israeli woman, the agency on it, the fault, the evil is reassigned to her. She gets called a colonizer. She gets called a settler, right? All of these words, all of these ways of signaling, you don't have to care about this person.
These individuals, people, groups, referring to the struggle as resistance. Rape is resistance.
Of course, yes.
So we see these horrific images of, as you mentioned in another interview, Noah Argamani being taken away on a motorcycle. We know of all of the horrific, or some of the horrific crimes being committed daily against men and women, by the way, sexual crimes, both in captivity and at Nova and on the highways in Israel. And this is all justified in the rubric of critical race theory, the binary power, powerful, powerless, and all Jews are evil and powerful and privileged and white, right?
Correct.
Okay. Wow. That's just not the reality I live in. I am heartened to learn that things aren't quite as sharp in terms of rape denialism in America as I thought. And so you see it primarily as a European, UN, and other NGO affliction. They're the ones who see it this way and promote this denialism / resistance.
Yeah, there was a clip that went viral of Judith Butler talking about, could be just that I'm maybe now in my own bubble, but I follow a lot of very left people. I have very close friends who are Palestinian. And all I saw was people just roundly mocking her. And even someone like Mehdi Hassan, who definitely hates me, been quite wrong about this issue. From the beginning, he has said, look, this stuff happened. There's no point in denying it. Like, we can oppose Israel's actions in Gaza without having to deny the atrocities of what Hamas did. We don't have to be on their side. And I took so much heart in that. I amplified it and I thanked him for it. And there's a concept of what is the mainstream in America. And the Palestinians' advocates are always complaining that mainstream is not actually in the center on the issue. It does lean more. There's just the American people will not tolerate anti-Semitism at the end of the day. They just won't, like the average Americans. That's not to say that the 20% who are college educated or over-credentialed and who are steeped in this worldview, that they're not trying to change that, right? Like, I think Rashida Tlaib would be very happy if that changed, but that will not change. This is the Golden Medina. It's still the Golden Medina. And there is an American exceptionalism here. I have a longstanding debate with a friend who hates my populism because he says that it always brings anti-Semitism. And I say, yeah, if I was European, if I lived in England, if I lived in France, I would not be a populist. And you look at who the Donald Trump of England is, right? This guy Galloway, George Galloway, just got elected. That guy hates Israel. He really doesn't like Jews, right? We don't, unfortunately, we don't have to struggle with that. Even the elites who are pushing the left ideas on this issue that I don't like, there's just very little of the denialism. Now, I could be wrong. I am not sitting in university classrooms, but this stuff has a way of getting out. The appalling stuff has a way of getting out. And I think a lot of what you're seeing in terms of the ugly protests, like, we didn't have mass protests. I think the biggest pro-Palestine protest we had here was, I don't know, 10,000 people. You know, we at the Jewish one, that was 300,000, right? Like, it's not that it's a competition, right? But I'm just saying, even I live in a neighborhood where there are a lot of Muslim immigrants. They live next door to Ukrainian Jewish immigrants and Orthodox Jews, and we all just want to get along. That's the American way. We all just want to respect each other's views. And I'll tell you one thing that I friends were saying, don't say this in public, but they put up in our neighborhood an American flag and an Israeli flag three months after October 7th. And I didn't like that. At first I saw it and I thought, yeah, that's right. Yeah, don't try any of your nonsense in this neighborhood. But then after a minute, I thought, I don't like that. I have Muslim neighbors. They don't agree with me on this issue. This is America. I tolerate them. They tolerate me. Why do we have to rub it in their face that our councilwoman happens to be like super Zionist? I didn't like it. And then they took it down and I was happy that they took it down. And I say that as like one of the more vocal pro-Israel. I'm an Orthodox Jew. Like, I'm living and breathing this stuff, but that's America.
Well, I hope you're right about American exceptionalism. Maybe we'll discuss that another day. I have to say I am a detractor on that, but I hope I'm wrong. Thank you so much, Batya, for being with us today.
My really absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the State of Tel Aviv and Beyond podcast. We'll keep the dispatches coming as frequently as we can. If you like what you're hearing, please take a moment, rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. You can check out our full library of articles and podcasts at our website, stateoftelaviv.com. State of Tel Aviv is an independent media venture, and we rely on subscribers to support our work. If you are not yet a paying subscriber, please consider taking the plunge today. Each person really does make a huge difference, especially in these very challenging times in Israel. It is important that you stay informed and current and seek out a range of perspectives. This is a pivotal moment in Israeli history. It is not a time to be passive and disengaged. Thanks for sticking with me to the end. I'm Vivian Berkovich, signing off from deep inside the State of Tel Aviv.